If you need help getting Social Security disability benefits, then this podcast is for you. Give me 15 minutes and I'll pull back the curtain on disability and reveal the secrets to winning I've learned over the past 25 plus years. Hi, I'm Jonathan Ginsberg, and I'm a practicing Social Security disability lawyer. I want to help deserving claimants just like you win the benefits you deserve and not one penny less. Now, if you already know you need help today, go to ssdanswers.com for a free and confidential evaluation of your case. It takes just 2 minutes. That's ssdanswers.com, and I'd love to hear from you. Now, let's start the show. Welcome, everybody. This is Jonathan Ginsberg here with SSDRadio.com. And I've got the pleasure today of speaking with a vocational expert witness. Vocational witnesses are used in disability hearings most of the time. And today, my guest is Stuart Gilkison. Stuart is a vocational witness, has been doing this for over a decade. And I'm going to ask him questions about what a VE is and what a VE does. Vocational experts, we call them VEs, because I think there's a lot of misconceptions out there about VEs. Stuart, first of all, welcome. Thank you very much for the time.
Thank you very much for having me. I've enjoyed your content over the years, both on YouTube and your podcast. Thank you for having me.
Well, I think we got, I reached out to you because you made a couple of comments on some of the recent videos, which I appreciate. And, you know, your perspective is obviously very different from mine. You know, I think a lot of people don't necessarily realize this, but in the disability world, as an attorney, the hearings are closed. So unlike other court systems where you can go observe other attorneys and hearings and so forth, in disability, you can't. So I don't really see what other lawyers are doing. I don't see, you know, how hearings go that are not mine. I sometimes listen to recordings if it's an appeal or something like that. But generally speaking, I don't know. So it's very helpful to have somebody else's perspective. And one of the things we'll talk about would be some of his, Stuart's observations about how attorneys handle cases and so forth. But let's start, I guess, by telling me, you know, from your perspective, what is the primary role? When you come to a hearing, you're called for a hearing, what is the role of a vocational expert?
Well, my role of a vocational expert is to digest the files that we get. We have access to the files that we can open up like a month ahead of time of a particular hearing. And I go through and look at past work so I can describe the past work. Within the past work is like, how much lifting was there? How was it stand? Inside or outside? But ultimately, I plan and start prepping a month ahead of time. Oftentimes, I prep it a month ahead of time, and then the day before, I look at it again just to see if any new exhibits have been exhibited. Ultimately, it's about determining what the past work was, but not planning for any questions that I'm expected from, that I'm expecting from a judge or an attorney, just describing past work.
Got it. And what type of training do most VEs have? How does one become a VE, and how does one get on the panel?
Well, for me, I have a master's degree in rehabilitation counseling from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And then I have experience doing job placement, job development, public policy. I also do like life care planning, which is determining cost of care from basically an incident to end of life. All of us, all the VEs have experience in working with people with disabilities at one time or another.
Okay. And basically you talked about answering questions from the judge. So obviously part of this, and at a hearing, one of the things that happens in almost every hearing is the judge will ask the vocational witness to describe a claimant's past work. And one of the resources that is used is something called the Dictionary of Occupational Titles. And this is something that gets a lot of press in the Social Security world and the various blogs and listservs, because the DOT, or Dictionary of Occupational Titles, is quite an old and outdated resource. So tell me about that. I mean, you're using the DOT, other things. First of all, for our people that don't know what the DOT is, can you tell folks what the DOT is and kind of why it is so controversial?
Well, the Dictionary of Occupational Titles, or the DOT, is pretty much a book that theoretically describes all the jobs in the national economy. The problem of which is over 80% of it was last updated in 1977. A lot has changed since then.
I would think so.
I mean, I was nine when parts of a good portion of it was updated, and a lot of it, the rest of it up to I think 1989 was updated. So it's really antiquated, and there are definitely jobs that just don't exist anymore, jobs that are just done differently, and sometimes it takes a little bit of work to describe past work that a claimant has performed, because it doesn't necessarily easily fit what says in the DOT. And there are times in which you just have to, as an expert, go into a hearing and listen to how the job was described subjectively, so you can actually pivot or be and be as accurate as possible.
Okay. And I know one of the things that will happen at hearings is you'll have a job, and then many times it'll be multiple tasks, and the VE will describe it as a composite job. So I guess you have some leeway to take these jobs and kind of combine them if they are not as described exactly by the DOT.
Yes, I do composite jobs often,
Okay.
just because the way you have, again, it's having to listen to the claimant talk about what they do. So sometimes it's like you see it described in the exhibits as I was a cashier, but when they're talking about the job, they're a cashier, but they're also a stocker, and that's two different jobs. And I do a composite job. So the cashier being a light job, stocker being a medium job, and generally when you do that, you do the higher level, the higher exertional level, and in those occasions they're both the same skill level. But yeah, I mean, composite jobs are pretty frequent and necessary.
Yep. And how would you know for a claimant, filling out the forms, and of course, Social Security, even though they are paperless, which I'll give them credit for, there's still a lot of forms to fill out. So when people are describing their jobs, what would be most helpful for you as a VE to understand about a person's job? What should they say? What should they focus on when they fill out these forms?
In the work history, there's a something called a work history form. Just being as thorough as possible, describing day-to-day activities, maybe even like hour-to-hour activities, how much lifting was happening, because there's a lot of the jobs that are described in the DOT that are light, but when you just hear them, and when you know as an expert that, oh no, nowadays that's probably a medium job, it's good to know all of those things, because roughly, I mean, what if RFC, residual functional capacity question, comes from the judge, the claimant can only do light work. Well, yes, but it was performed at the medium level, so they can't perform it anymore.
Got it. Got it. And when, of course, sometimes the issue comes up, it was as performed by the claimant, and sometimes as performed generally. So that's a difference too. Is it
Yes,
not?
it is. It
Yeah.
is.
Okay. Now the DOT obviously being outdated, I know sometimes you'll hear vocational witnesses refer to other publications. What other resources are out there that vocational witnesses use other than the DOT?
Beyond professional experience, there's a Journal of Forensic Vocational Analysis, and I get that through the American Board of Vocational Experts that oftentimes really talks about jobs, specific jobs like surveillance system monitor, which you might see a lot in the hearings, or counter clerk, whether or not they actually exist anymore. And again, I also talk to peers that are doing more placement than I do. Just exactly what's out there anymore.
Got it. Got it. Now, being a vocational witness is really not supposed to be adversarial. I mean, I tell my clients that the VE is not there to help you or hurt you. The VE is there to answer questions from the judge. However, there is a school of thought among some attorneys who do disability work, some very good attorneys. They take a very aggressive approach towards cross-examining a vocational witness. What has been your experience? Do you find most lawyers are more treated more non-adversarial, that some of them treat it very adversarial? What's your experience with that been?
Well, I've had you once of the in the
Okay.
12 years, and you're not adversarial.
Right.
I mean, you
Correct.
might ask the there's certain attorneys will ask the typical questions like what's the off task percentage, and what's the absentee level that's acceptable. There are firms out there that are more adversarial. primarily they will attack job numbers. The job numbers are not reliable. Where are you getting your numbers? And you know, they try to, yeah, they have like a, I want 30 days post-hearing to come up with a post-hearing brief to attack the VE and say that the job numbers are not reliable. But what I say to other, what I've said to judges and what I've said to attorneys and other peers is they never seem to be bothered by the number zero, which I get the same, I get to zero as I would get to any other number using the materials that I use. But yeah, it's primarily it's job numbers. And you know, I've dealt with this long enough that I can deal with it. I mean, it's, but I can tell you judges generally don't like it. And ultimately, I don't know if it affects the numbers in terms of approval rating at all,
Well,
because
that's
it's hard to see.
my sense is, and I've never taken the adversarial approach unless it's clear the VE just is not qualified. Now, there have been a couple of cases over the years where a VE will just come out with something that's just bizarre, and I'll ask, where did that come from? But for the most part, I don't, because my experience has been the same. I don't think judges really like that. They don't want, they're not looking for situations for VEs to be attacked. And again, if you're going to question the numbers, do it in a brief. But I don't, that's my take. And again, there are plenty of attorneys who see it the other way, and that's fine. That's just the way they do it. But I think if you're having to go after the VE, you probably don't have a great case. And from my perspective, and again, this is just me, I mean, the margins in disability work are not that great that you can spend all your time writing appeals, and making law. And so that's just not me. And again, other folks see it differently, and that's fine, but that's just not me. Now, we talked a little bit about jobs that that don't exist anymore, because obviously the VE is very, very old. I assume when you're doing your preparation, you kind of eliminate from your consideration jobs that don't really exist, or don't exist the way the DOT described them.
Most certainly, and I think there was an article in the Washington Post a couple of months ago
Oh, yeah.
that talked about some of these jobs.
Yep.
And it's true. Again, with the, there's something, there's a sedentary unskilled base. Within the DOT, there's 137 jobs. The sedentary unskilled base, 93.7% of those were updated in 77. So most certainly, a lot of them don't exist. And if you look at it, and you know, there's a lot of jobs dealing with buttons and eyeglasses, and they just aren't done anymore, or they're not done in the same way. So I mean, again, if somebody's been waiting for a hearing for 1 to 2 years, I think it's actually getting shorter now, but 1 to 2 years, they deserve an expert on the other end that has taken the time, the due diligence to say, oh, well, this job doesn't exist anymore. Or if, and the jobs that are there, they're actually pretty small. I mean, you're talking about production level jobs. There are not a lot of them altogether. I mean, they just don't, either don't exist or the numbers are really, really small.
Got it. And I guess with these some of these jobs, when vocational witnesses, identify some of these jobs, I've had people say to me, well, I live, let's for example, I'm in Atlanta, although I do cases all over the country. I'm in Atlanta. There are probably not a lot of jobs involving fisheries or jobs involving, ice, moving ice or something like that. Does that come into play when you're identifying jobs for a VE? If let's say you're doing a case and let's say I think you're in the Midwest someplace. Am I
I live in Madison, Wisconsin.
okay? So you're in Wisconsin. So there probably are not a lot of jobs involving, I'm guessing, involving fisheries there. I don't know if there's any, if there are any jobs that would be relevant to that. Does that come into play at all to consider the regional realities of jobs and what exists, near where the claimant lives? Or is that even part of the equation?
That's not part of the equation anymore. It generally, it used to be. It used to be that, you know, a judge would ask us the numbers in the nation, the numbers regionally. So in terms of like fisheries or semiconductor stuff, yeah, for Madison or Wisconsin, that's not really the case. But maybe 7 or 8 years ago, it just went strictly to national numbers. Theoretically,
Interesting.
somebody can move. Now, I've had judges that ask, that still ask me for national numbers, and I get that. I've had one judge that asked me for a five-state region, which I can get that. It's just a little extra work. And that's so it's good to know kind of what a judge might ask in terms of will he or she will ask about a region or a five-state region, so you can have the numbers at the ready. Because the last thing I want to do is like stumble and say when I get a question, I just kind of want to have everything ready to go.
What other change, you mentioned that the judges are no longer asking necessarily for regional information. What other changes are you seeing in the way the questions the judges are asking vocational experts?
I mean, they are asking where I get my numbers from.
Okay.
That's relatively new. That's somewhat within the last year. There might have been a training that they're really asking where the numbers come from. And for me, I get the numbers from a particular software program that uses something called the North American Industry Classification System with the Occupational Employment Survey. And I know it's like I'm throwing around a lot of like letters and terms, but it comes up with an estimate of a DOT code within a larger group, and it's a way to have a more precise estimate, and it's still an estimate. And then you still have to take the due diligence that say, well, this job really doesn't exist, or this job is part of a larger job, which I see a lot too. There's a job within sedentary unskilled, which is a dresser. I don't know if you hear that one a lot, but
Occasionally
it's
here.
you're addressing envelopes.
Right, a dresser. Yes, correct.
And in the DOT, it describes writing envelopes. And let me tell you, it doesn't happen.
Right.
It doesn't, but the numbers would show you that they're actually pretty big. But generally, if you're addressing an envelope, you're probably doing something else. You're an office clerk, you're filing. And so that's just another job that I throw away because it's not relevant anymore.
Got it. And I assume that when you're preparing for hearings, there's a certain number of jobs that you've got kind of that you can kind of turn to that you know, because obviously you're going to get these questions a good bit, that you sort of pre-selected as far as not necessarily for that particular claim, but just that, like you said, there's certain jobs you get rid of just because they're not really relevant. So you've got a list of jobs that you're ready for, sedentary, unskilled, or light, semi-skilled, things like that. Is that, am I accurate with that you're
Yes,
saying?
I generally stay within the unskilled base. Unskilled base anywhere from I can go to heavy unskilled to sedentary unskilled. I have it like at my fingertips, but I have quite a few jobs, a lot of jobs actually kind of like mapped out. Like when I first started this, I basically mapped out the DOT with by standard occupation code, the SOC codes. So I can just look at this, my files, and say these are all the jobs that are within those codes. So I could actually, be really, really quick at what I do. But yeah, there's a generally, and you'll probably see this too. You probably see this too with VEs. There's generally a small band of jobs that you can use, and which becomes, not problematic, but interesting when you have a judge. You have like five or six cases in a day, and you have the same RFC for five or six cases, and you're saying the same job. I don't want to do that, but sometimes just
You have no
that's the way
choice.
it is. Because sometimes some of these jobs, the other jobs, the numbers are really, really low. And judges don't necessarily want to hear, oh, there's 50 of these jobs. Because ultimately you have to determine whether or not there's enough jobs in the national economy that a hypothetical individual can perform. So but yeah, I there's a small kind of band that I use. And then I also break it down, when you if you like you get a hypothetical question about a sit stand option, I have sit stand jobs, jobs that have occasional contact with the public. And but I mean I've done it long enough that they're almost even memorized that I know where to go and kind of what the numbers are.
Don't know where to begin? Get my free Secrets to Getting Approved Survival Kit. Inside the kit, I discuss such things as how do you know if you have a case? What to do if you're denied? How to avoid common mistakes? And my ever popular, how to avoid trick questions from the judge. Subscribing is free and easy. Just visit ssdanswers.com and look for the survival kit for instant access. Remember, time is eroding your position every day. Don't delay, act now. That's ssdanswers.com for your free survival kit. Got it. And of course, you're, now that the hearings are done remotely, you've got, you have, I assume you have a computer program or something that gives you access to this. Because what'll happen at a hearing, for those who don't know, is the judge will rattle off this very long hypothetical question with, about, 15 or 20 different, subsections to it. And I'm, busily typing, writing it down. And of course, you're trying to come up with a job right off of that. So obviously, I'm assuming that there is, you sort of have things kind of at the ready for those type of questions.
Yeah, I have things at the ready. I don't want to be stumped. I don't want to. I mean, you judges, I mean, you could have a judge that has hearings 30 minutes apart or 45 minutes apart, or judges that can go an hour and a half. So you have a judge that have hearings that are 30 minutes apart. You don't want to take too much time because that's just going to throw it off. And when you throw it off, it just it's a mess overall. But yeah.
Let me ask you a little bit about transferable skills. That comes up. And again, for those who don't know, if you would just tell me how do you perceive, what is a transferable skill and why is it relevant in a vocational inquiry like Social Security?
Yeah, a transferable skill. Generally, a hypothetical individual that has a job, and it has to be a job that is either semi-skilled or above, a job that like with little or no vocational preparation can take those skills to another job and just kind of walk into it. And for the way I do it, well, there's one, there's something that I have on my iPhone that actually, it's kind of like a transferable skills like finder that gives you a good start, but I really try to stay within the absolutely same area of like a job area. So hypothetically, if there was somebody that was like a manager of a shoe store, I'm not going to say they have transferable skills to be a manager at a fast food restaurant because you have to learn the industry. So for me, transferable skills are just really, really small. A small part, and I don't like. I have to be honest. It's like generally, it's going to take a person a while to learn a job.
I
So
would think so. Yeah, I mean, I think especially in this day and age with all the, the computer programs and things like that, if it's if they've got any kind of skills involved, it would seem to me that it would take a while to really get, competent at that job. All right. Let me ask you just more general questions. You hear a lot of claimants testifying. And one of the things I spend a lot of time with my clients on is preparing them for testimony and what they need to, mistakes to avoid. What are the mistakes that you hear, if anything comes to mind, that claimants make when they're testifying? You're listening to a lot of hearings from a lot of different judges and so forth. What are the biggest mistakes that you hear people make at hearings?
Well, more often than not, I have a job, you'll have a judge that ask, well, do you think you can go back to that work? And a claimant would say yes. Or do you think you can do this job? A claimant will say yes. When I had a like there's some particular judges that, describe your day if a hypothetical individual doesn't say, I get up and I take my meds. It's like, well, are you compliant with your medications? There are some judges that don't like claimants that are emotional at all, which is really hard to see. Again, as somebody's been waiting a while for a hearing and they start crying, that's normal. And that should be it should be okay, but some judges out there don't. So it's primarily like, can you do your past jobs? Or, I mean, I've had heard claimants like saying, I don't drive anymore at all. But the judge says, well, he says here in exhibit, 6F that you drove on a vacation or you drove to the appointment. Judge claimants that say, I haven't ever taken any illicit drugs, but it's in the
In the
files.
file, yeah. No, I think that's right. I mean, I tell people never speak in absolutes because never means never. And like you said, if they say I never drive, but they drive to the store, they're driving. So yeah, that's apps. In fact, I did a whole video about that, about, I called it the trick questions that a judge might ask you. It's really not a trick question, but yeah, judges look at the record and they'll ask you a question. And if you mislead them about something, if you say, I never do something, but in fact you do, your credibility goes out the window. So
Yes.
I'm definitely, I think you're really seeing the same thing. Speaking in absolutes, the other thing I always tell people to avoid is not very long or not very much, not very far. That doesn't say much. You know, you want to be as specific as you possibly can. Because you can't do anything with that. If a, you know, if a judge says, well, you know, claimant can't sit very long, well, what does that, that doesn't help you. You know, what does that mean?
Yeah.
Absolutely. How about attorneys? You hear a lot of attorneys presenting their cases. What are the mistakes or things they do well? What are the things they do well or mistakes that you hear?
Well, you know, the mistakes that the attorneys make is when they don't ask any questions at all of me. They allow the judge to ask all the questions, and sometimes they don't even ask questions of the claimant. And I'm just sitting on the
Really?
other end and I'm saying, come on, in my head, say, ask something. Because ultimately, it is an attorney's job or a non-attorney representative's job to make me say zero. You know, make me say there are no jobs out there. And that can happen in any number of ways because of a medical concern, not being able to do the job sit or stand, or I can't lift at all, or I'm going to miss too much. There are any number of reasons you need me to say no jobs, but attorneys that don't ask any questions. But generally, I'm finding, you know, the attorneys that are with have their own firm, smaller amount of cases that they take, they tend to be kinder. And you know, when we had in-person hearings, you could just tell they turn and they face the client and they just talk generally and kindly, and that's what I like to see. Because ultimately, every VE, I mean, I came from working with people with disabilities and I still do, so I'm not an awful person that wants to prevent somebody from getting their benefits. So I like to see kindness. I don't like to see like coldness. Another problem I see is generally the big box firms that they meet the client the day of the hearing. They
I've
don't
seen that.
know. You know, it's like, again, bigger box firms. It's like sometimes they get farmed out to somebody else, and they just have never maybe even met or talked to the client before the day of. And you know, that's not the way things should be done. Again, because people are nervous, and it's just kinder.
No, I agree. I mean, I used to, when we would do live hearings, and of course now we occasionally do them, but you'd walk into a hearing room and you'd see a lawyer in there saying, is Mr. Jones in the courtroom or in the waiting area here? And the first time they met him was 10 minutes before the hearing. And you know, you gotta look, you gotta get to know me. I had a couple of pre-hearing calls right before this call, and I was talking to a guy, and you know, there were a couple of things he told me about his past work that I wouldn't know. And until he told me. And so I'm like, okay, well, that kind of makes sense what you're doing. I mean, you know, he was described as one thing, but it turns out he was doing a lot more physical stuff. So yeah, you got to talk to your clients and know what's going on. But I definitely think that's the case. It is amazing to me that somebody would ask no questions. And I will tell you that their judges sometimes will ask, you know, that threshold question of the claimant being off task 15% of the day or missing, you know, 2 or more days of work a month. And, you know, I'm not going to repeat if the judge has already asked that. But yeah, usually there's something you can ask. And really, what I try to do when I'm preparing my direct exam is I will, you know, I'm trying to make my case so as if the judge was taking, you know, the hypothetical question directly from testimony. I want to have at least that, so I can say, well, if the claimant is found credible in saying, you know, that he can only sit for 15 minutes at a time, or that he can only lift, you know, 7 to 8 pounds, you know, what does that mean? And obviously, the answer there should be no jobs. But yeah, that just takes a little bit of preparation. And actually, speaking of the this question about off task and missed days from work. I have found that there can be sometimes there can be a difference of testimony. Now, I'll have some VEs talk about, well, 10% off task is too much. And some will say less than 10%, maybe 7 or 8%. Some will say as much as 15% of the workday outside of breaks being off task. And that's the way they ask the judges ask pose the question. If our claimant is off task for 15% of the day or more, what does that mean in terms of being able to sustain employment, or how many days of work a person can miss? Why is there such a discrepancy? Why do VEs have different answers for those questions?
Well, for off task, I haven't personally read any peer-reviewed articles about off task percentage. So generally, when it comes down to off task percentage, it comes down to the professional experience of the VE. So for me, it's 10%, and this is for unskilled work. It's 10%, and I've done some research on like Department of Labor statistics, and in terms of like production, and in terms of how often is a person on task, and adjusted like in the reverse is it winds up being about 10. So that's what I go with, but there's nothing universal, and certainly you're going to see a wide range. And I've heard about a wide range of just talking with judges and other attorneys that some VEs will say 15 or 20, and it doesn't match what I say, but there's nothing standard.
Got it. Got it. And I guess a final question that you mentioned, because I would assume that there are times when you're talking to the judge without the claimant or claimant's rep there, not about a particular case. Is there much conversation with judges between hearings, or is it pretty much when they call you, and that's pretty much it?
But when it's gone went down to like virtual or on the phone, the judges will basically they'll call you like right before the hearing. They don't give you any kind of time ahead, you know. But part of it has to do with the technology too. You know, the technology is not fantastic. I don't know what you're saying. You have dropped calls. You have dropped videos. It's really different, you know, because you, I mean, it used to be you get to see the claimant, which I'd like. I'd like. It's not gonna for VEs, it's not gonna go back to that because our contract says it's all by phone. So even if all the offices are open again, everything's to go, hypothetically, let's say COVID is over, it's not gonna go back to that. So it's hard to, you know, like when do I speak? When do I pause? I'm a fast talker, so there's that too. So when I'm talking about DOT codes, I talk too fast. Yeah, I don't think it's going to go back. But no, there's no talk with a judge generally. I mean, how can I say that? There are definitely kinder judges. There's some judges that are really, really kind. There's some judges that are more stern. You get to know those judges either way, but you know there's generally no talking. You don't want it to be in a situation like you talked about a hearing ahead of time. That just doesn't happen. That's like when in a hearing you talk about a hypothetical individual, and you know at the end of hearing you generally don't say anything. What I'm having happen is they generally hang up on me, and then they'll call back. So it's colder than it used to be. But that's just going to be the way it is.
Well, I think, I mean, again, I think for a lot of people, they don't know who the VEs are, and I always try to prepare them. There's going to be a person here that you've never met who's reviewed your record, is going to be testifying in your hearing. And it's kind of a strange concept if you think about it, that, this person you don't know is going to be there. But on the other hand, I've never really seen a situation where I get the sense that the judge and the VE are having inappropriate conversations. But even with live hearings, I think, I know some of the VEs and the judges were pretty friendly, but I never got the sense there was much going on other than just, social chat. So I suspect probably you're right, less so with the virtual hearing. So,
I
all
mean,
right.
there's definitely a disconnect because when it was in-person hearings, if I'm walking down the hallway, I might look like any other SSA employee. I don't work for the SSA, so you know you get to know staff and you get to know judges. So, let's say somebody retires, I don't get invited to the party. I'm not part of that, so there's a total disconnect. So
Got
then
it.
another important thing for like claimants to know is like again, we're not colluding against you to prevent you from getting your disability, because I know it's stressful. Like when they ask judges ask the first question, like the RFC, I will say a ton of jobs. Sometimes you can just tell it crushes a claimant, but we're not colluding. It's just
Here's answering,
ultimately,
right. You're answering questions the judge gives you. So if the judge gives you a question with very few limitations, that's your job, is to give answers. But I try to tell folks, that their judge may ask five questions, and two or three of them may have a lot of jobs, and they're really just kind of trying to draw a line. And whether you win or not, it's going to depend on where they fall in that line. One of the hypotheticals reflects what the judge is thinking, and I guess they have to go through that to satisfy the people that review their decisions to make sure they've considered everything. So that's the way the system goes. Yeah, it's a very interesting process. And again, the VEs, like you said, I think a lot of people think they're there to hurt them, but they're really not. It's just more of a just information gathering, because ultimately disability is about vocational capacity more than anything else. It's not about the medical, it's about how the medical affects you. So that's why they're used. That's all the questions I have. Anything else come to mind that you want people to know about VEs or about what you do that we've not covered?
I think going back to the RFCs, I think it's important. What I'm seeing judges do recently is the first RFC is going to be reflective of what the agency says, the Disability Determination Bureau. And then the second is more along the lines of what was heard during a hearing. But generally, I have no idea what's going to happen. No idea what's going to happen, where it's going to, where the judge is going to lie. I mean, occasionally you'll have a judge that goes to attorneys like, just to let you know, I'm more leaning towards hypothetical number three, which is work preclusive, but generally I don't know.
Yeah,
I mean,
that's true.
again, I like the work. I like the work. I mean, again, I kind of fell into it. I like the work. The other thing is what your claimants are probably going to start seeing is there's a rotation now of vocational experts. So for a month, you're going to see a certain set of EEs. The next month, you're going to see another set of EEs. So they're rotating us month to month now. So one month I'll work with one office, the next month I'll work with another office, and there's no rhyme or reason, and they won't tell us what the rotation is. So you're going to see a lot of different VEs, probably.
Are you getting cases? Are you getting work from different hearing offices out of Wisconsin, nationally or just locally?
Wisconsin, Minnesota, Illinois,
Okay.
Indiana, I think maybe even Ohio,
Okay, so
generally.
it's multi-state. Okay,
Yeah,
that kind of makes
I'm
sense.
in region five. Things were different earlier. I mean, I was doing hearings out of the Southeast, Northeast. I've done California hearings, but they keep changing the method of how we get our hearings, and which is just interesting. It's nice to have like different judges, but I like to be in a rhythm of knowing what's going to happen with an attorney or a judge or a staff. But yeah, it's changed, and it'll change again.
Yeah, I'm sure it will. I'm sure it will. Well, it's an interesting area. Again, I very much appreciate your time. I think, again, there's a lot of misconceptions out there about vocational witnesses, and now we've uncovered some of it, at least I hope. But I really appreciate, again, you taking the time to speak with me, and I'm sure my audience does as well. And hopefully, I'll see you in a hearing coming up at some point.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you again for having me.
You got it. Well, that's a wrap for today's episode. Subscribe to this podcast for regular updates at iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you found this podcast useful, then please give me a 5-star review, because it helps others see the value of my information. Thank you in advance. For a 100% free and confidential evaluation of your case, visit ssdanswers.com. That's ssdanswers.com. Don't delay. Act now.